Information you'll need is behind tab 8. It's basically six documents. Document 1 is the meeting summary. Document 2 is documents relating to priority settings in previous years and CRP fee-funded projects. There's a list of council work priorities, Document 2A. Document 3, which you'll probably want to pull out, is the Federal Register rule concerning the exempted fishing permit process, because we're probably going to spend quite a bit of time on that. Document 4 is our committee policy for incorporation of research results into management. And there are two final reports there, which are documents 5 and 6, which you may want to reference as we go along. I'll start off with an update on recent activities. Dr. Poey briefed the committee on the CRPP activities. He reported that the program is likely to be level funded. That is, funding would be similar to last year. Ongoing initiatives that are currently supported through this are the operations of the Research Steering Committee, enhancement of the study fleet, the Maine New Hampshire Inshore Groundfish Trawl Survey, the NEMAP, which is the Northeast Area Monitoring and Assessment Program Survey, which, among other areas, includes gaps in the Science Center Bottom Trawl Survey between Montauk and Martha's Vineyard. Cod tagging, which is no longer actually tagging fish, but it's analyzation of the data in order to have the results available for the upcoming cod stock assessment, and the Marine Resource Education Program. Also, it should be noted that while it maintains its status as a separate entity, funds for the Northeast Consortium also are channeled through the CRPP. NEC funding was eliminated by Congress in 2008, and this is a matter of great concern for the Research Steering Committee, given the level and quality of research that it is heretofore supported. In a way of background, I should tell you that the reason that we don't have hard budget numbers or hard and fast information to produce at this time is that as part of our collective tax cuts, government agencies are being asked to give back a portion of their budget to pay for it. So they may lose a portion of the funding, and they don't know exactly how much as of when we receive this report. Additional Science Center initiatives under consideration include a monkfish survey, a dogfish tagging initiative and workshop, a region-wide meeting of the parties involved in cod haddock and yellowtail flounder and monkfish tagging, continued halibut tagging, and squid mesh selectivity work. Given these possibilities, current needs, and other aspects of the budget process, it is unknown at this time if they'll do what's called a BAA, or broad agency announcement, which would be a request for proposals to do research. So we'll have to keep you posted on that in the future. Does anybody have any questions on that or comments? Okay. Let me move on to the we did review two more projects here. These were two good projects. They produced a lot of results. I'll take them one at a time and see if people have any questions on them after I'm done. The first one was the survival of sublegal cod in the Northwest Atlantic longline fishery. This was done in association with the Hook Association and Henry Milliken from the Science Center and Mr. Farrington from the New England Aquarium. This was also a consortium project. It was reviewed thoroughly by their panel of technical reviewers. Basically, the proposal, the PIs had proposed to quantify the mortality of sublegal cod on Georges Bank during various seasons and at various depths. And to do this, they basically did a cage study in which you capture control individuals, and then you capture fish during using your usual method of fishing. And then you put them in a cage and you lower it back to the bottom. You leave it for 3 days and you come back and see how many fish are dead. The project noted varying mortality rates depending on the depth and the temperature and the method used to unhook the fish, whether they were unhooked by hand or put through the crucifier. Obviously, as you would expect, putting them through the crucifier increased the mortality. One of the things they also noted was that in their control fish, they had an 11% mortality rate. And in this case, their control fish were caught using jigs. So that's an important result in itself. It indicates that there is some mortality associated with hook caught fish, even under ideal conditions. I mean, we have a number of people who come to this council and say, oh, no, I release my fish, they swim away, and they're alive, and everything's fine. Well, they may be alive when they, you know, when they let them go over the side, but according to this study, three days later, under the best of conditions, 11% of them were dead. So that was the basic tenet of the study. It did find, as I said, differential mortality rates ranging from 38% to 100% in the fish that were released from the long lines, depending on, again, on depth and pressure, and that's all in the report. The committee agreed that the project information did not lead to definitive results in terms of a recommendation on mortality rates for discards from hook-caught fish. And that's because in order to do that, you'd have to know every long line set, what depth it was in, what temperature it was at, you know, whether the fish were put through the crucifier. You know, that's a level of information that is not collected on in the logbooks. But we still believe it should be turned over to the various assessment people so they can incorporate the results as they see fit. There were added comments that the effort illustrates the difficulties in incorporating the results of this and similar experiments into stock assessments. And this had to do with the notion of cage studies in general. Cage studies are the accepted means of doing mortality studies, but they come with their own set of problems. On the one hand, you put a fish in a cage, which obviously is a stressful situation. But at the same time, you also protect that fish as you lower it back to the bottom in the cage, where if it was just released from the boat, you could have mortality that you haven't measured, such as, you know, sharks eating it, striped bass, whatever. So on the one hand, you get some positive effects. On the other, you get some negative effects. They're virtually impossible to quantify. So you have to kind of look at this and say this is the trend that it indicates, that this is, but the numbers are probably not absolute. Okay. Because of the technical difficulties associated with determining overall discards in most fisheries, such work, the committee felt, may support best practices research, which would be, okay, we've identified a problem. We have discards of sublegal fish. They have mortality associated with them. Best practices would be to do research to try and not catch those fish in the first place. For example, maybe a minimum hook size that would prevent the fish from taking the hook in its mouth, a sublegal fish. So the committee recommended that perhaps that would be a direction for future resource to try and reduce the capture of sublegal fish in the hook fisheries. An audience member pointed to another important issue identified by considering this project, that such studies may point to other types of research priorities. As I said, for example, more conservation engineering projects that focus on selectivity. The committee commended the PIs for their initiative in undertaking a follow-up experiment that corrected some deficiencies in earlier work and agreed to direct the report package to the Council's groundfish committees and its plan development team for use as appropriate, as well as to the Science Center for consideration in stock assessment processes. So I'll stop there at the moment and ask if anybody has any questions on that particular report. Yes, Paul.
See the relevance to stock assessments, but there's a huge relevance that I hope the committee at least, you know, recognized, is that when the council sets its ACLs, it has to consider discards, because it's total catch that will be allocated if we're going to allocate to different sectors or to, recs and everyone else, and that I think that there'll be a lot of assumptions of discards, and that the more hard evidence we have of discards, I can see, you know, fishermen saying that, say that the SSC or whoever does this estimates a certain amount of discards. If there are experiments and data that says, no, 20% is too high, it's 11%, then, you know, are we going to use it or not for management? And what are our standards, you know, for how are we going to determine discards? Is it going to be average set by the SSC or the, you know, the assessments? Or You know, how, what kind of detail are we going to use that catch information? So experiments like this, I see more of them coming from different groups to determine what kind of discard information are we going to use to determine our allocation.
Okay, there's two issues you've raised. One is, in this case, they were trying to determine discard mortality, so they set out to catch these fish, to catch sublegal fish. So it may not be representative of the amount of fish that are caught by long lines of hooks. So you can't use it to determine the discard rate. You can look at it to determine discard mortality. If we want to measure discard rates, that's going to require more fine-scale information collected from all the fisheries. That would be through the observer program in the commercial fisheries. And quite frankly, I don't know how it would be done through the recreational fisheries, probably by placing observers on the boats to measure the number of sublegal fish that are caught. And then, again, you could apply these rates as a best-case scenario for jig-caught fish. 11% of the fish died. This was with people reeling them up slowly, you know, only taking the strongest fish and lowering them back down in the cages. That probably would tend to indicate that the actual mortality rate of jig-caught fish is probably higher because they would not be reeled up slowly. They would not be sorted through to get the strongest fish to use for the controls. Nancy?
You're doing a really good job answering the question, so I appreciate that. You know, and I also appreciate where Paul is going with this. I mean, from our perspective, there are still significant holes in that need to be filled relative to life history for some of these really important species and stocks. There's no question about it. Monkfish, I think, is a very good example. And so, in our view, directing monkfish surveys to fill in some of the gaps, particularly for the larger and older fish, is absolutely essential. But Paul is right. I mean, there has to be some discussion. We have to collectively, I think, figure out where it is that we're going to go in terms of estimating discard rates and discard mortality rates, which are two different numbers. And as it is now, we go through a process, a modeling process, obviously, in the assessment. And those estimates usually come out as a process, as a function of the modeling process. So they're developed internally within the modeling and the assessment. But quite frankly, where we want to be is in terms of discards and really in all these parameter estimates is moving towards empirical estimates. And those are estimates that are actually derived from doing experimental work. And so for discards, you know, my small experience with discards is that it really takes a concerted effort and significant funding to do both experimental and laboratory work, observers, which are always expensive, and additional work looking at how to mitigate the discard mortality. So, I think Paul is being appropriately forward-thinking, and I think it would be good probably to have a discussion, and probably the Research Steering Committee is the appropriate place to have that discussion about where it is that we really want to be in terms of developing these empirical estimates as opposed to the internal estimates. And what we do in the assessment is we have empirical estimates of fishing mortality rates, but there's a disconnect between what we see in terms of total mortality that is not always explained by our natural mortality estimates. And that's where we look at these things in terms of discard mortality rates. So I tend to agree with Paul. I agree with you, Dave, as well. You're doing a good job, like I said. But it is a discussion that needs to happen.
Thank you. Does anybody else have any questions on this report? Okay. I would note one other thing relative to this subject for people that may be listening to the tape or whatever later on, that there is somewhat of an inverse relationship between discard mortality and stock abundance. This is something that people have a real hard time with, that a lot of times, because you don't have 100% mortality associated with your discards, that you actually have less fish out there than you thought you had, not more fish, because fish are in essence being recycled. They may be coming to the surface several times and being counted numerous times before they're actually, removed one way or another. I wouldn't want people to think that because we have said that the discard rate is not 100%, that implies that things are better than we thought they were. It doesn't necessarily mean that. So I really want to stress that because That's exactly what happened in Fluke, where the discard rate was determined to not be 100%, and that actually meant there were less Fluke out there than were assumed, and that led to some of the management issues in Fluke that currently exist. So I don't want people to take away a false positive from a study like this. So I'll move on to the second one. The second one was a testing of low-profile, low-cod bycatch gillnets. It was done by Mike Pohl from the Mass Division of Marine Fisheries and industry partner Bob McKinnon. This was also funded by the Northeast Consortium. They hired a panel of technical experts to review it, and those reviews are included. And the thrust of this experiment was to test experimental designs to reduce the vertical profile of flatfish gillnets. So they tested various types of so-called flounder gillnets and exploit the behavior differences between cod and flatfish observed by fishermen, which suggested that cod, perhaps travel a little higher than the flounders, and therefore the cod might go over the flounder nets, and we could reduce our catch of cod using these nets. And so the null hypothesis here was that the nets do not reduce the catch of cod, and they went out to test that. The project was successful. They set alternating strings of nets, and they compared the catch rates of cod and flatfish between the so-called stand-up gill nets and the various iterations of flatfish nets. And they produced a differential catch rate of cod. Basically, the various flatfish nets reduced the catch of cod by 50 to 60%. That's an important number to remember because, again, if you'll remember in past council meetings, people have come to the council and said we could reduce our levels of cod catch in gill nets to levels approaching zero if we only use flatfish nets. And this empirically shows that is not the case, that it's on the order of 50 to 60%, which is still significant, but it's not 90. So this was a way to confirm information reported anecdotally by the industry. The Research Steering Committee members agreed that the experiment confirmed that reducing the vertical profile of gillnets has implications for protected species interactions as well as potential reductions in catches of groundfish stocks of concern without loss of targeted species. In particular, the Research Steering Committee wanted to highlight the second paragraph of Principal Investigator Michael Pohl's response to the technical reviews, noting that one reviewer may not have been familiar with the operations of the gillnet fishery for groundfish species in the Northeast, and that overall the committee agreed with the technical reviews, except where noted, and considered the work well done and successful. Members supported forwarding this package to the Council's Groundfish Committee and its plan development team for their use as appropriate. And I also want to note that since Mike Pohl is a member of the Research Steering Committee, he recused himself from the discussions of this work. And to further kind of clarify to people this issue of one reviewer apparently didn't understand the Northeast Sink gillnet fishery. He had recommended that they alternate the nets within the panel, that you have a stand-up net, a flounder net, a stand-up net, a flounder net. And for those of you who know how gillnets work in the Northeast, that basically the fish will tend to follow the panel and then dart for any place where it has a reduction. Mike did not feel that was the right way to conduct the experiment, and the committee agreed with him that you needed full panels of nets, a panel of flatfish nets and a panel of stand-up nets. You couldn't alternate the nets within the string because that would introduce a bias into the experiment. So if anybody has any questions on that, I'll be glad to answer them. Okay, great. Okay, now, the next topic is going to take a little while. And I would ask you to reference document number 3, which is the Federal Register notice of the provisions for the experimental permitting process, exempted fishing permits, and scientific research activity. What I propose to do with the chair's permission is to basically go through the bullets that we've identified one at a time and see if anybody has any comments or questions or things that they want to have considered on the bullets. And then once we're done with the bullets, see if anybody has any further issues they want identified. So the first bullet is that the proposed rules measures were difficult to understand, in particular the definition of gear testing as compared to conservation engineering. The Research Steering Committee would like the rule to explicitly clarify the term gear testing with examples of how its definition, as proposed, would be applied versus the proposed rules defining conservation engineering activities in the Northeast. And I'll explain the two terms briefly. Because this is a document for all the regions, it covers a number of different practices within a number of different regions. And in Alaska, they have gear testing. They have actual zones set aside where you can go out and take a net and tow it to test the net's efficiency. And you're required to keep the cod end open because this is to measure things like door spread, wing end height, whatever. And they actually have zones set aside for that. And so in this case, at the federal level now, they are calling what we would think of as work on, say, a Nordmeer grate, conservation engineering. What they refer to as gear testing is taking your net out, towing it with the cod end open, and doing net measurements to find out if the net is actually effective. The terms are used throughout the document. It's very confusing because people, at one hand, say, well, why have I got to keep my cod end open if I'm trying to test a bycatch reduction device? And what they really, that isn't what they really mean, but that's what the document tends to lead you towards. So that's a point that they're going to have to straighten out. I mean, it's just very, very confusing. And so that was our first point. I'd also like to point out that I don't know if Paul Perez is here today or not, but Paul was very, very helpful from the regional office staff in clarifying the words in this. It is a very dense document. It's very difficult to deal with. And every single word means something. So you have to basically take it word by word by word. And it's only, you know, 7 or 8 pages, but we spent the better part of 5 hours on it. So does anybody have any questions on that? Okay. Second, the Research Steering Committee also discussed at length what would be considered research activities under the proposed rule. Research activities can be conducted under a letter of acknowledgement, which is referred to as an LOA, rather than under an experimental fishing permit. And the LOA has simpler and quicker processing requirements than the EFP. Therefore, bringing more activities under a letter of acknowledgement, or LOA, was viewed as desirable by the Research Steering Committee. The proposed rule may allow for more gear research activities to be considered scientific research, a scenario that should reduce time and workload for applicants and NFS to review these proposed activities. But again, it's this idea that it's very confusing as written. And so what the goal of this from Congress, as best we can understand, was to simplify the requirements for environmental assessments or draft EIS for people going out to test bycatch reduction devices, gear research. And it doesn't appear to actually do that. Any questions on that? Okay. The third one. The proposed rule notes that the public notice process via the Federal Register used by the Mid-Atlantic Council for its research set-aside funded projects is incorporated into its annual fishery management plan specification process. Approved experiments are described and impacts analyzed in specification packages, which are then subject to public review and comment periods, thereby streamlining the process to review and issue these experimental fishing permits. The proposed rule exempts the Mid-Atlantic research set-aside proponents from the need to apply for a separate experimental fishing permit, as well as the associated Federal Register notification procedure. This exemption does not apply to the New England Fishery Management Council process. Further, the Research Steering Committee viewed it as its possible inclusion as unnecessary and a confusing item because most New England Fishery Management Council fisheries do not have annual fishery management program specifications. Also, they noted that including the experimental fishing permit public review period in the New England Fishery Management Council Fishery Management Plan Fishery Management Actions would further complicate the development of major fishery management actions and supported the continuance of the current BFP notification process. I know that's a lot of words and a lot of technical information, but basically, again, because they're trying to do this at the national level, they're trying to combine regional programs. Basically, the regions a lot of times have worked out quicker and better ways to get things done that are unique to each region. And the comment would be that we'd kind of prefer to keep that regional approach rather than having an overarching federal approach. Okay. Any comments on that? Pat?
Go ahead. No.
I can't see the end of the table.
You sure? Okay. Just to clarify a little bit, because I see some frowns around the table, and I know this was an issue of concern for some council members. The point here was that at least in the preamble, this proposed rule described a process by which you would not get a Federal Register notice that set out the proposed EFP and allowed you to comment on it. It implied that that process would be skipped. And as John mentioned earlier today, he would like those Federal Register notice with potential EFPs and an opportunity to comment to come before the council. The proposed rule makes it sound like that step is going to go away. Once you get into the weeds of the Federal Register notice, it actually doesn't say it has to go away for us, but it may go away. That extra step may go away for the Mid-Atlantic Council because they approve all of their experiments associated with their RSA program and put them in their annual specs package where they are analyzed, and that whole process goes out in the usual proposed and final rule. So you can make comments at that period. You do not need a separate opportunity to comment on an experimental fishery permit. It's all done in the specs package. So the long story is, or the short story is, that we don't have to skip that process, but the MID may skip that process because their experiments are analyzed in an EA or EIS and goes through proposed and final rule. If that helps.
Jimmy Rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't believe that's a real good description of what takes place. I'm not trying to be argumentative here, but all we include in our specifications is a specific percent of each TAC, of each stock, that is set aside for research. There is absolutely nothing to do with any of the proposals or any experimental projects. The specifications package, it takes a special motion just to say that we'll set up to 3% of some of flounder aside for research. So up to 3% of scup, up to 3% of black sea bass. That's all that does. And then the steps that are necessary to get the experimental projects, of course, we don't know what they are. You know, we're doing this in August, and then you've got till, I believe it's January, February, to make a determination of which are valid projects and which are not. So, I mean, maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're saying, but as far as the specifications go, they only relate to the set-aside that is for each species at that time. Nothing to do with individual projects. That's my recollection of it, Mr. Chairman.
Mike Petney.
Yeah, if I can just clarify maybe briefly for the council, the process, it's really a process that we use at the regional office, not something that's council specific. The way that under the current process, in other words, no change to the regs, we have to publish an FR notice announcing, the receipt or the intent to approve an EFP. For the Mid-Atlantic Council research set-aside projects, which we know about and have information on before we publish the proposed rule for the annual specs, we simply combine those two things into one action. So the proposed rule also announces the proposal to approve EFPs for those projects. We could do that now for New England projects if we had all the information at the appropriate time. What this rule does is actually says for research set aside projects, or for EFPs needed to implement research set-aside projects, no FR notice would be required. So that step would go away for all councils, all research set-aside programs. Now, the preamble, as Pat mentioned, is kind of confusing on that issue, but the reg text is actually quite clear.
I guess that's where I have a problem with this proposed rule, and maybe my understanding is maybe I have the incorrect perception, but what you just said is once an RSA is created and EFPs apply for, projects apply for EFPs against that RSA, no FR notice is required.
That's what the rule proposes.
Yeah, that's my problem. I don't like that, quite frankly. I think that if we're going to set aside 1, 2, 3% of available harvest, I think the council should know how that harvest is being utilized and for what purposes, where, and how. If concerns about access to closed areas with that RSA, habitat areas, so on and so forth. So I think I personally have a problem with that, and I think the council should think a lot about whether or not it wants to support a process that essentially hands over the decision-making authority, not that we have any right now, but hands over the opportunity to comment on proposals that could, in fact, have an impact on some of these areas that I've described. Paul Howard.
Mike, it says here that approved experiments are described and impacts analyzed in the specification packages, which are then subject to public review and comment periods. So these impact analyzed, are they done by Mid-Atlantic staff, the PI, or NIMS staff as part of the package?
It's a combination of all three. It's again, this is a process that we worked out with the Mid-Atlantic Council staff to streamline our ability to approve and implement the EFPs for their resource set-aside projects. And because the decisions to approve the projects are done, basically by August, and then we receive a specs package in September, October, and we go out with a proposed rule following that, by that time, we can have the information to analyze the impacts in that document so that we can, basically it becomes one action. The EA for the specs covers the research set-aside projects and the EFPs. The Section 7 review under ESA for the specs covers the EFPs for those projects. And the FR notice on the proposed rule covers our public notification process. So that when we issue the specs, and the specs become effective January 1, we are prepared to issue the EFPs as soon as the grants are awarded. We don't then have to start another process to review and approve the EFPs.
So each fisheries management plan that has a spec would have its own related set aside with experiments. So you do it. If you had four plants with four spec packages, you'd do it four times.
Not necessarily.
So you can take another plan's RSA and do it at the same time that you're...
Yeah.
So you can do it.
Again, it depends on the projects. Many of the Mid-Atlantic projects, because they can request research set-aside from multiple species, they'll get X amount of summer flounder, X amount of scup, and X amount of squid for a single project. So we'll use this, because the summer flounder specs tend to come out first, we'll use that. It's not combining so much as using the specs as the vehicle for conducting the analysis on the individual projects and announcing the likely EFPs on the individual projects. It's really just what vehicle we use to append this information.
Dr. Pierce.
Well, I do appreciate the need to streamline the process and why it seems to make sense for NIMS staff to work with Mid-Atlantic Council staff to make this go fast. However, I do agree with you, John, that there really is a need for others to have an opportunity to see what's being proposed and to comment. And I can say that from the perspective of the Division of Marine Fisheries, where I oftentimes, always, have a very difficult time finding out what exactly is going to happen with the research set-asides for scup, sea bass, and fluke, for example. You know, the quotas for those particular species continue to drop, and as a consequence of that, those fishermen who are not involved in research set-aside initiatives wonder well, how is this other amount set aside for research going to be used? Because they're seeing their own fishing activities being reduced. Review is necessary. In theory, the interests of my state would be addressed through the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission and the involvement of the executive director at some level with an awareness of what's being proposed, but that really is inadequate. So, once again, I support your perspective and the need for that more open process and an opportunity for comment. It becomes even more important for me as an individual policymaker in my agency when, after the projects have been approved for the research set-aside, I get phone calls from those who have been given the research set-aside for exemptions to state rules so they can fish inside Massachusetts waters to do their research. And my question always is, well, what research are you doing, and what's the justification for it? It complicates matters dramatically. Therefore, if I'm involved in the review process early on, I'll be in a better position to comment to the proposers that what they want to do in my waters, on my state's waters, might actually be inappropriate and can conflict with state rules, for example. So, again, I share your perspective.
John Nelson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Jimmy was and I were just talking about this, and it seemed like there was a disconnect, and maybe I'm just not making the connection. The specs are set at a certain time for the research set aside, but then you send out RFPs, I would assume, to meet that. So are we just a year behind as far as the timing associated with what's being proposed here? And in that timing of sending out RFPs and whatnot, before you have the approval process and putting them out to rulemaking, I would think there's an opportunity to have a step in there so that the council and whoever understands what has been, what proposals have been received before they even get published that they were selected and these are the ones that are going to be funded. There must be some timing in there that provides that opportunity. And is that's I think the part where I know I'm a little confused. And when Jimmy mentioned it to me, I thought maybe that's where the scenario that we could provide that step if it's not already in there. Am I correct in the scenario as far as the specs and then the RFP being solicited?
I think so. The RFP essentially is out right now for the 2009 fishing year. And so those projects will be prepared and submitted in the coming months. The Mid-Atlantic Council's Research Set-Aside Committee will meet, I think, in May or June to review the proposals and the technical reviews and basically make a recommendation as to which projects should receive funding pending the availability of quota. Because the regs are specific that up to 3% of each year's TAL may be set aside for research. So the research projects will be recommended. Those then come to the council in August, at which point the council sets the specs for 2009 and can decide, or at that point we'll know whether the projects that are recommended for approval are within that 3% for each species. And then at that point they've received preliminary approval and they initiate the grant process.
So why wouldn't we, I think the whole thing is timing, and why wouldn't we do that similar type of timing if we could, which has the step in there for the council to review prospective proposals?
Well, I didn't get the sense reading the Federal Register notice that timing was built into the process that was being proposed. Is it?
This rule doesn't speak to that because that process is internal to each council's and each research set-aside program's procedures.
Sorry, Mike, I was in a sidebar. Can you repeat that?
The rule doesn't speak to that.
Right.
Because I think the procedures that John was referring to are internal to each council's research set-aside program. So they can differ, even within a council, they can differ by FMP. The monkfish procedures that we follow for that set aside are different from the Sea Scholar procedures that we follow for that program. So the timing is dependent upon the FMP and the procedures established for each program. This is speaking, the rule is speaking in much more general terms.
Right. Anyone else on the council? Good, Dave.
Okay. Item number four. The proposed rule would allow for National Marine Fisheries Service observers and biological technicians to sample fish on commercial vessels without an experimental fishing permit, but would require university and other fish sampling programs, for example, state programs, to have an experimental fishing permit. This distinction is an impediment to research and should be addressed to promote partnerships to accomplish cooperative research and not create roadblocks. Any questions on that one? Okay. Fifth, the proposed rule maintains the NEPA review requirements for issuing experimental fishing permits, thus keeping the process administratively burdensome. The Research Steering Committee does not have a specific substitute to recommend, but believes, again, in keeping with the congressional mandate to expedite the issuance of experimental fishing permits, that the NEPA process is not the model to use. Alternatives should be explored and substituted. Comments? Questions? Okay. The proposed rule would allow the National Marine Fisheries Service to charge a fee for issuing experimental fishing permits. The Research Steering Committee is not in favor of charging fees for experimental fishing permits. Questions? Comments? David?
Can we go back to four for a second?
Okay. Yep.
This really is a question for the service. You've noted that, your committee has noted it. The proposed rule would allow for NIMS observers and biological technicians to sample fish on commercial vessels without an EFP, but would require university and other fish sampling programs to have an EFP. Just a clarification, what's the logic for that particular distinction? It escapes me.
Mike, do you have any insight? No. Ron, you have insight. Come forward and share it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz. At the meeting, Paul Pera basically said that when they really looked at the rules, that if there was an observer, a NIMS observer on board a vessel, but not as a part of an observer program, let's just say a NIMS employee or any government employee, and not covered by the observer program, that they were illegally, if they were retaining, for example, small fish to the side in a fish box, that technically was illegal if the vessel was boarded and the person would be subject to action. So this is to put an exemption for NIMS employees that might be on board a vessel conducting catch analysis, for example. They forgot that there are other people that might be in the same shoes, such as a state employee or a university person or a Cunnamusset Farm person. So it's just an oversight on the part when they were dealing with it.
Ron, what's a farmer doing on a fishing boat? Okay. Anything else on number four, Dr. Pierce?
No, I'm all set.
Dave?
Okay. Number seven, because the proposed rule actions are extremely confusing, it is difficult to understand how they would affect experimental fisheries processes in the Northeast. Research Steering Committee strongly recommends a description, for example, a side-by-side comparison or a flowchart of how the new rules application process would be simpler than the old rule. Basically, show us examples of how this will actually work. And I think if they actually do that, they may find in some cases it is more more cumbersome, and they may help guide the people who are writing the rule towards making it simpler. So they basically recommended that you create some flow charts under the old rules and the new rules and compare them and see which one works better. Any questions on that? Okay.
Dave, just before you leave this issue, that's it for the...
That's it for bullets. We just had one last statement.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Overall, the Research Steering Committee judged the proposed rule to be unclear in many cases and in need of further work in general if it is to expedite cooperative research. Further, it does little, as charged by Congress, to promote regionally based processes. Those were our comments. I think you have until March 20th to actually comment, if you want to comment as a state or as an individual. And I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, how you propose to move these comments forward. Perhaps you'll address that.
Yeah, we... Pat?
Just an additional note about some research steering conversations. The reason that we're all having such difficulty, and thank you, Mike, for helping out, is because NIMS staff at the meeting, the people who have read the proposed rule, people who are in the room that have been through the EFP process, found this particular FR notice to be one of the most confusing, and we've seen a lot of FR notices that we've ever taken a look at. It's convoluted, unclear, maybe in some cases the wording is not, I don't want to pick it all apart, but there was a discussion about actually, instead of simply forwarding comments, to ask NIMS to withdraw this rule, and the basis for withdrawing the rule is all the reasons we stated here, but also the lack of clarity and the amount of confusion. And there have been other suggestions to even ask, invite those people to come up to hear the regional perspective, because in conversation with Mike earlier, almost all the EFP the permits that are issued come from the Northeast. We have far more activity here than any other region, in fact, all of them combined. So if the council wants to deliberate that, I think it might be really useful. It's very scary to have this particular rule go forward to final form with just a couple of suggestions. So I think going back to the drawing boards and on the basis of these comments might be something the council wants to consider, because it's tough going otherwise.
Pat, you took the words out of my mouth.
I didn't mean to.
Amazing. Remember, we asked the council to, or we asked the RSC to look at this rule for us and come back to us with their perspective. We've seen it. We've got seven bullets anyways, concerns or criticisms of the rule as written. And it was my intent to forward a letter on from this council containing these bullets, but also I want to have a dialogue about just what Pat talked about, a withdrawal of the proposal, and request that they come to the region and work with us to clarify things. It is very confusing. I can't understand how compensation fishing fits into the research set aside versus how it fits into the EFP process. It's maybe it's just the terms and the definitions are different than what I'm accustomed to, but at least for me, after reading this three times now, I'm still not clear what can and can't be done, and that scares me. So if there is an objection, I'd like to write a letter on behalf of the council and submit it in comments and request that they withdraw the rule for all the points that we've talked about this morning. No objection. Dr. Pierce? No objection. Okay. Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, Rev. Yeah, I support that for a number of reasons, many of which have already been highlighted by David and the committee, and there's one in particular that is of great concern to me, and it needs to be addressed. We'll offer this up as formal comments from my agency that's been involved, of course, in many scientific research endeavors in cooperation with the commercial fishing industry, conservation engineering, of course, being at the top of our list. And the issue that's of concern to me is the manner in which a scientific research vessel has been defined. And as far as I'm concerned, the way these regulations are worded right now, it would mean that if Division of Marine Fisheries initiative, with our scientific staff on board a commercial fishing vessel or a recreational fishing vessel are doing work, conservation engineering work, we would have to get an EFP because that particular initiative would not be, according to the rules and regulations, be done on a scientific research vessel. I'll elaborate, of course, in written comments, but frankly, as far as I'm concerned, that if we have a fishing vessel following approved scientific protocol and having federal, state, or university scientists and technicians on board, you know, to oversee and to supervise the research and the disposition of the catch, then that should fall under the definition of a specific piece of scientific research being carried out on board a scientific research vessel. But I understand there's some controversy there. But nevertheless, it would make matters so much easier and would just strengthen the partnership that you know, states, universities in particular, have with the federal government for doing all of this critical cooperative research work, whether it's conservation engineering or something else.
Thanks, Dave. I also want to be clear. We've gone through the effort and made the decisions to set aside quota in of species in various FMPs. I agree with the intent or the drive to put this register notice together. We've got to streamline this process and make things easier for people that want to conduct research. Right? I don't think this does it, and that's my objection to this register notice. It's not that we're going to ignore the purpose of what this was trying to achieve. It's that we need to do it right for us. John Nelson.
Well, I don't disagree, Mr. Chairman, with that approach, and I assume in the letter you're also going to just request the, as you mentioned, the opportunity to get together and go over things so that it could be clarified. And a letter is very nice, and I get a lot of them, and I read them, and I'll leave it at that. To actually get to achieve your goal, I would suspect that it actually has to be done on a informal basis also, making sure that the intent of what our concerns are merely to try to streamline things even further or clarify them or modify our process to fit what they're doing, but in a clear basis. So I guess it's a question of how else would you also follow up on that to try to achieve that, and whether we can get additional support from maybe the federal partners that we might have at the table.
You're asking what else am I going to do besides write a letter? It's a sensitive question, John.
Actually, it's not, Mr. Chairman. I know you have a process here, and you know the feds have a process in place. I think, though, that sometimes a letter doesn't provide as much clarity to your intent that a phone call will also help do. That, I think, is summarizing what I was trying to say.
Okay. I'm comfortable answering your question now. Yeah, phone calls and meetings will probably precede and follow up the letter. Drew?
Thank you. Drew Minkiewicz, Fishery Survival Fund. In my former position, I had a little bit of background in this provision in the Act, and I just want to say I wholeheartedly agree with the direction the Council is taking in this in their comments and asking for this rule to be withdrawn. My former job on the Commerce Committee, all I heard was how complicated and difficult the experimental fishing permit process was and how it needed to be refined, made easier, and done in a way so that these projects could go forward in a timely fashion and come up with results that could positively affect management. Unfortunately, from reading the Federal Register notice that's come out on the proposed rule, the agency has taken it in a complete opposite direction and made it more cumbersome, more difficult, and it will negatively affect management. And the one of the things here, unfortunately, is we have to use available catch to subsidize the science because the resources aren't there. And if you're going to do that, you have to have a flexible provisions and ability to actually do this in a timely fashion. So what you're doing by sending asking this to be sent back is absolutely correct, because when this provision was written, it had a completely different outcome in mind than what is happening right now. And so we encourage you to go forward, and also encourage you to make sure that research set aside provisions in New England can go forward as quickly as possible as well. Thank you.
Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz, Kunimesset Farm Research and Education Foundation, Incorporated, a not-for-profit in Massachusetts. Dana Morse up in Maine is trying to put together a session at the Maine Fishermen's Forum to discuss this very issue, because a lot of the people involved in research are concerned. And if that moves forward, it might be a good session to have both council and regional office participate in. One of the things is that comments are due by March 20th, and I think as a backup to our, I strongly support asking NIMS to withdraw the rule, but we should also probably try to develop a set of regional recommendations over and above just the critique. Almost, we've had over time since 1996 a number of things on the table that we hoped would improve this process, and it would be nice to get those and send them in at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Was just talking with Rip. One of the other things I'm going to do is talk to some of the other council chairs and see what their reactions are to this rule as well. And I suspect there's an equal amount of confusion spread throughout the country on this, and we may be able to pen a letter under all mastheads. We'll see. You know, I'll look into it. Anything further on this issue? Dr. Pierce?
Is that, I would assume that this perspective is shared by Pat Kirkle. And therefore, being the regional administrator who would potentially share this perspective, there'd be some internal discussions which might help convince the writers of this proposed rule that they need to do a little rethinking and consult more closely with the Northeast region. I'm, of course, suspecting that might be the case.
Pat?
We will also be providing comments. That's all I'll say.
Okay, anything further on this issue before I turn it back to Dave? Okay, Dave.
Thank you, everybody. It's appreciate the feedback. The next issue we had was to address research priorities for inclusion in any potential broad agency announcement. And to that effect, I believe we have a motion to put up. I'll give a little background while that's going up on the board. Again, because the budget situation is still fluid, we don't know how much money might be available for any work, but it probably won't be much under any scenario. So what we did is we took the research priorities of all the species committees, and we really had Adam to try and come up with what we really need the very most here, given the very limited amount of funds that are available. So I guess I'll read this into the record now, that we would ask the council to support the following as 2008 priorities for inclusion in the National Marine Fisheries Service broad agency announcement and for use by other funders of cooperative research. First, to develop gear that would separate haddock from all of the species in the eastern U.S. closed area. Second, develop species-selective gears that will reduce the capture of dogfish and reduce the capture of skates, in particular thorny skates, in fisheries where these species are taken as bycatch. And third, to develop and implement a data collection slash monitoring system. Whoop, what happened? Monitoring program that would promote accurate, fine-scale, spatial accounting of all catch components of the multi-species fisheries to include landings, bycatch, and discards. And those are our three priorities that we've boiled down from the list that were provided to us, which in some cases included 25 from a given species committee. So I guess that's a committee motion, so I don't know if it needs a second from this particular committee or not.
No, it doesn't need a second.
Okay.
Any discussion? Dr. Pierce?
And number three, do you mean just develop the data collection monitoring program as opposed to implement?
I think it says develop and implement. So we want to do both. We want to develop a system and start using it. Because of all the reasons that Paul and Nancy mentioned a little earlier. I mean, we need this information. And under the new rules, we need it yesterday.
I had a question, Dave. Number two, it says in parentheses, in particular thorny skates. Is there a reason it doesn't say thorny and winter skate?
I think it was felt that in the case of winter skates, that there is still an active fishery for winter skates, and that will probably still be allowed to continue in some form, as opposed to thorny skates are a prohibited species. You can't even possess them. We were hoping to, you know, hopefully come up with a gear that eliminated thorny skates from the catch altogether, recognizing a 25 rebuilding period, and that probably for a good long period of time, nobody will be able to land thorny skates.
Dr. Pierce.
Regarding number one, develop the gear that would separate haddock from all other species in the eastern U.S. Canadian area. This proposal is being made, I assume, because of results of that haddock symposium that was held. In other words, a lot of work has been done on this already, the development of gear that would provide for the separation not just in the U.S.-Canadian area but elsewhere. It seems that's been a focus for a long time, and a great deal of work has gone into this. So could you elaborate a little bit? Does the research steering committee truly believe that there's something else out there that actually could be used. We haven't exhausted all options.
What this discussion revolved around was the fact that it appears that in order to gain access to the eastern Georges area for any length of time, we're going to basically have to only fish for haddock and treat everything else as a bycatch. That every time we allow any yellowtail to be caught, any cod to be caught, the thing, you know, opens up for a couple weeks and then it closes. So we recognize there are gears out there. We're going to have a discussion later on today about the eliminator trawl. But we don't think that we should be locked into just one gear. There may be other gears still to be developed. I mean, there may be better mousetraps still available, and we don't want to preclude further research that would hopefully get us to the point where, I mean, the eliminator trawl eliminates the bottom-dwelling species, the yellowtail, the skates, the lobsters, and it eliminates about, I believe, 50% of the cod. I don't remember the numbers right off the top of my head. But, we would still like a perfection that eliminates everything but haddock, that basically would allow this area to stay open year-round without fear of it closing because it runs up against these other species, the cod and the yellowtail, that cause it to close. So that was the thinking behind the committee.
Nancy?
Not to that point, but I had another question that was related to the BAA. And when there's inclusion about language about the BAA, is that in terms of what happened last year in FY07? When we had an agency-wide BAA, or is this something that is much more specific and in anticipation of ending funding that might come through the Center for Cooperative Research?
I'm going to have to defer to Pat perhaps a little bit on this one, but my impression was of the discussions that we had felt there would be perhaps limited center funding, and it would be very specific to that, but also to basically let anybody else that has fundings, whether it's the consortium or National Science Center or all the people that have money out there, that these are things that the New England Fisheries Management Council would really like people to be working on, that these are our true priorities. And, Pat may wish to comment further.
Pat, there was a question on the which there was a reference to the BAA, and Nancy had a question as to which BAA are we talking about, the broad agency BAA or a specific BAA if funds become available through the center?
The broad agency BAA for 2008, if a broad agency announcement is possible because of the level of funding. Specifically, that's what the focus was. However, recognizing that, as David said, there might be other funders out there. We generally do that every year. If the consortium should get funding, we give it to them. GMRI, they get funds from other places, and so everybody knows what our priority is regionally. Priorities.
Okay, that clarifies it, because the rules have changed as far as dealing with some of these earmark funds are concerned, and I think that's what you're talking about. Last year we had a broad agency announcement that rolled up all the earmarks into a pot of money, and that pot was distributed among the various regions. Now, I don't know what Pat's budget looks like, but, of course, we always get a lot of earmarks. The anticipation this year as far as rules for earmarks are concerned is that, again, it's wide open as far as the soft earmarks are concerned. We have two types of earmarks. We have a hard earmark that comes in that has appropriation language that tells us what that earmark is for. We have soft earmarks, which is what you're talking about. It's pretty clear from this administration and that our rules now are that I am individually going back to those folks who have responsibility on the other end of the doing the work end, as far as the soft earmarks are concerned, to ensure and justify that those earmarks are mission relevant. So that's part of this as well. So what I'm saying is that I don't know, I don't anticipate that there's going to be any agency-wide earmark. But my marching orders are to go back to people with these soft earmarks and say, I need to go back to Congress and my administration and defend these earmarks as being mission relevant. And so that's where this comes in as well. So, I mean, it's good to have the discussion and to have the priorities obviously on the table. I brought this up at the Mid-Atlantic Council as well because they were going through their priorities. I need to match my priorities with your priorities, and clearly we're doing that because we're a part of this process. So, but my job then is to take these and to match them with the funding that's available, regardless of where it's coming from, and then justify that funding. So I'm just letting you know, because I think it's important that everybody knows that the rules have changed as far as dealing with some of this funding is concerned. And, you know, there's good news and bad news associated with all of these things. But that's where we are as far as dealing with the earmarks are concerned. And that's what I anticipate as far as a agency-wide BAA.
I think that's one of the reasons we tried to really cut to the chase here. I mean, we have, if you look at these lists, I mean, they're more wish lists than priority lists. And, you know, basically, number one was to address the concern of foregone revenue to the nation because we can't access the Haddock in eastern Georgia. Number two was, again, this idea that we've got to do something to eliminate thorny skates, or they're going to end up shutting down more areas of the ocean and we're going to lose more revenue, which is foregone benefit to the nation. And the third one is to address ACLs and AMs. We need this fine-scale information in order to better understand discard and mortality rates. And catch rates by area. So, you know, this was after, you know, 2 or 3 hours of relatively intense discussions where people, defended various programs that they really thought were necessary, and this is what we came up with.
John Nelson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for Dave in regard to number three. Was the discussion revolving around the ACCSP programs and the standards that are associated with that for data collection?
No, John, it didn't address that specifically.
This
was more, again, from the Science Center-driven aspect of what they had to do to potentially meet ACLs and AMs.
Yeah, well, I think we ought to keep in mind, again, that we have an agreement amongst all the states and the federal government and the councils to develop data collection programs that meet the standards of ACCSP. And I would want to make sure that type of notation is in there so that we don't start having programs developed that start going off in their own little direction. And that's what we've been striving for almost 10 years now to avoid, and millions of dollars have been funneled into that to make sure that we have it as uniform as possible amongst all agencies. So if it's okay that that's the intent, using the ACCSP standards, that's fine. If we need to amend it, Mr. Chairman, to reflect that, I'd be happy to request that be put in through an amendment if I need to.
Dave, the discussion at the RC, was it focused on ACCSP? Was that discussed?
No, it was not discussed.
All right. I think we'll need an amendment to the...
All right. And before I do that, I would just, again, point out for the future, since I might not be here, that the, any of the data collections, we're all trying to work together to get data collections, and we're trying to have uniform standards to do that. And so anytime you start talking about data collections and monitoring programs, they should be reverting back to what are the standards that probably have already been developed, and make sure that if there's something new, that as much as in sync with that program as possible, so that we maximize the dollars that we do get for that. So I would just suggest as an amendment in number three, the words developed according to ACCSP standards.
There's a second motion. Seconded by Terry. I have a question, John.
Yes, sir.
What does ACCSP stand for?
Atlantic Coastal Cooperative Statistical Program.
Okay.
And that's...
I know you just described it. Is it a program that all the states and the federal government are working together on? So it is the standard?
It's supposed to be the standard, Mr. Chairman. There is nothing else out there. All reporting forms and everything are been made uniform according to that, and it's a progressive, evolving program. But yet, that coordination between all agencies is what is keeping it focused.
Okay. Any further questions, Paul Howard?
I think. Like I mentioned before, number three, I think, is going to have an awful lot of relevance as we start to allocate the different sectors of the fishing fleets, et cetera, and we need more information to better, more accurately allocate. And I had thought that the study fleet was embedded in number three, that we had talked about a study fleet to gather better data on bycatch and all kinds of stuff, have it real-time stored. And I think, I don't know where that program has gone, and I don't know if it's been going on for 5 years. What have we done with the data? What has it told us? But more importantly, we should develop some type of plan that says, okay, we need to get this fine-scale data to better allocate that and better do stock assessments that Nancy was talking about. And what is our plan to get that in number three? Do we want to do it piecemeal to the different fisheries, different gears, different areas? Or do we want to have a plan that says we're going to start with sectors to get better data for sectors that are in existence, or, Georges Bank over Gulf of Maine, or, if we're going to collect data, we've got to have a plan for how we're going to do it in terms of supporting fisheries. So I guess my first question is, where is the study fleet? Is that a vehicle that can satisfy this requirement, one of the vehicles? And, has anyone evaluated how that experiment has done?
Yes, the study fleet is actually listed at the beginning of the report as something that will be continued to be funded, and it is capable of doing what you say. It's being expanded to a number of fisheries. number of vessels. One of the things they're looking at the moment is actually trying to get a snapshot of the fleet, if you will. How many boats would you need to equip with in the study fleet to have a representative picture of the fishery? In other words, are the boats that are in it right now representative of their aspect of the fishery? As an example, is me as an inshore dragger representative of inshore draggers in general? Is a given hook boat representative of given hook boats of the hook fleet in general? They've also put it on. It's being used in the hagfish fleet at the moment to gather quite a bit of information about the biology of hagfish to get some idea of that fishery. Hag, slime eels. But it is under the update of CCRP activities on page 1 and the top of page 2, it is one of the items that they propose to continue funding and to use it to address item number 3. But it is not the exclusive way of addressing item number 3.
Sally McGee.
Yeah, I'm curious if there was any discussion about, again, under number 3, about the work that GMRI is doing on this right now and how that is advancing the questions of monitoring and how additional efforts outside cooperative research that are ongoing right now are going to be integrated with trying to deal with these high-priority questions.
There was no specific discussion of it, no.
And just one other question. Maybe I missed this at the beginning, but is this in order of priority, 1, 2, 3?
No.
Pat, you did have your hand up, did you?
Yeah, I just wanted to tell the council, in case you were left with the impression that no follow-up or review of the study fleet had been done, that the council a year or so ago requested and received a peer review of the study fleet, and we had the document here in the binder. It's kind of old news now, but largely it was focusing on the electronic reporting component of it. It was a hardware issue to get people to use laptops, select proper fields and so forth, and to report back in real time to the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. And all that is going along, but it's been developed and is being used as more or less pilot programs on a smaller scale, like David mentioned, the hagfish fleet, and I think there were some on tilefish boats and things like that. But anyway, that work is ongoing, and I think progressing, according to Dr. Hoey's report, progressing very well. And I think the idea was to, if there was an idea to incorporate the study fleet into an address number 3, that was great. I mean, there's been a very large investment in the study fleet program, and so if we can capitalize and build on that, terrific. But we didn't specify it in the...
Paul Howard.
I think my point was that, you know, the overall study fleet, trying to get a whole idea of discards and the entire groundfish fishery, or a monitoring aspect of the whole groundfish fishery, might be extremely costly, and in the end, you know, you wouldn't be able to get a good look at it in terms of what are the discards or total catch. But you might be able to have a small-scale plan to look at inshore fisheries in Ipswich Bay and really look at what's being caught, what's being discarded by season, by vessels, and be able to, you know, to do the little fine-scale adjustments that we need to do for 2-to-1 blocks, 3-to-1 blocks, spawning stocks, you know, areas and things like that. So instead of looking at the big scale, I think the study fleet should be looking at smaller scale to better determine, you know, collect data and determine allocations and things like that.
Well, I think the people that run it are looking at exactly how they want to use it. You know, they are doing that kind of an analysis to see, for example, as I said, do they need one boat out of 30 in Ipswich Bay, and that boat is representative of the other 29, or do they need 3 or 5 or 10 or whatever? They're using the information they've gathered so far to look at that and see if it is, you know, how many boats you need to do exactly what you said. Are they, in fact, representative of the fleet? And they also are looking at how many people would participate in this and gather the information that is required, which is extensive and intensive and requires a lot of work on the vessel operator's part. So it has to be people that actually believe that what they're doing matters, that just giving a computer to some guy who then goes out and throws a bunch of information in because he doesn't really care, he just wants the money, is not going to work, that they have to have buy-in, and that subset of people is relatively limited. It's not the entire fleet. But it is being analyzed. I mean, I'm trying to answer your question as best I can. And as soon as we've got some more information on what that analysis looks like, I'll be happy to bring it to the council.
Anything further? All right, Ron, come on down again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz. I just want to suggest that 1 and 2 are, from a creative problem-solving standpoint, are not worded right because it sort of jumps to the conclusion of what the solution is. It would be, I think, more constructive, for example, say instead of saying develop a gear, to develop and demonstrate a clean fishery, because there's a lot more than just the gear. For example, it might be just a different gear type conducted where the fishery is conducted at a different time. On number two, the thorny skate issue, again, is a very species selective issue, and I looked at some data, and I think the major problem with thorny skate is that the rolling closures open up right on top of the densest concentration of thorny skate and all the fishing efforts right on top of it. So if somebody demonstrate a clean fishery might be a better way as opposed to just looking at jumping to the conclusion that it's a particular gear design. I mean, I know everybody's focused on haddock separator trawls, but I think one could develop a very clean gillnet fishery out in the eastern area, for example.
Okay, back to the council. Anything further? Dave?
Yeah, to address Ron's point, could we simply substitute methods in place of gear? Does that work for the maker of the motion? Broaden it out a little bit. You could include gear parenthetically as an example of how to do it, but it is a good idea to sort of back up and just look at broaden the problem solving possibilities.
I don't know if I can speak on behalf of the committee in this case. I mean, I don't see a problem with that as an individual, but I don't know if I can say on behalf of the committee I'd say that. The committee was pretty specific in the wording on these on this motion. I mean, this is what they wanted after quite a long discussion.
Yeah, I mean, this is a council motion now. It came from the committee, but now it's...
Once it's on...
Do you want to modify it or whatever you want to do?
Yeah, I'd move to amend it then to substitute methodologies in place of gear in one. So, sorry. And in two, right?
Seconded by Jim Salisbury. Discussion, Jim Odlin.
I'm in favor of the motion. I think it's a good idea that, it could be simple things as time area differences, and I think it would be important to flush those out in order to let us try to get better yield on these stocks. So I support the amendment.
Dave Preble.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's really kind of a small point because you can't use gear without method, but the reason that the committee was specific about gear was we're looking at short-term research priorities, and we wanted to narrow it down as much as possible. Ron's point is well taken, that we do need to develop methodologies as well. But given the fact that we were looking at short-term research projects that would identify specific gear types in more of an engineering sense, that was the reason that the committee went that way. I don't feel strongly enough about it to argue it heavily one way or another, but that was the thinking of the committee, was to zero in just as much as possible in the short term. And the reason for that was because we had We've got very limited resources, financial resources, and the idea was let's look toward the engineering of specific gear types, because there seems to be quite a lot of good work being done in that area right now.
Anything further on the motion to substitute? Ready for the question? I'm waiting for John Nelson's face to not look puzzled. Okay.
You're just amending the motion. You said substitute. That's why substitute motion. And I think
it does say amend, and I thought I heard Dave Simpson say substitute, but it does say amend.
Yeah, I moved to amend to substitute the words,
okay.
I think.
Okay. Need another coffee. On the motion to amend, all those in favor? Fifteen opposed. One opposed. Motion to amend carries. Now, on the main motion, any further discussion? John Nelson?
Yeah, just technically, I had suggested, and it is in there, the language, and we did have that as a motion, and I don't think we voted on it, Mr. Chairman. I think Terry had seconded our motion, so.
I guess I interpreted that as the ACCSP thing as a friendly.
Very, very friendly.
We were still new into the debate on it.
I just didn't want to have somebody later say, well, geez, did we vote on that? Could we include it? So thank you for your clarification, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any objections to that? People clear on that? Okay. The main motion is amended. Ready for the question. All those in favor? Sixteen is unanimous. Dave, anything else?
Just one last brief thing. The committee began work to develop research priorities for an initial five-year period in keeping with the reauthorized Magnuson Act. This plan should address fisheries interactions, habitats, and other areas of research that are necessary for management purposes. This plan will be submitted to the Council's SSC for final approval. So we just began work on it. We haven't completed it yet. And that concludes my report, Mr. Chair.
Pat, do you have anything else? Okay. I'd just like to thank Dave and Pat. I think you've done a great job here, especially on that EFP dissection. You helped me out a lot, and I think the Council as well. So thanks for a good job. We're going to take a 15-minute coffee break. Over to the chair, Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.